so they can see you. Okay?
Rolling?
Okay, thank you for being on time. It adds to my health. It's very hard for me to be Talui B'Dein Acherim. You have to understand my life story. First of all, today is, let's get it straight, today is November 8th, 2010, Monday morning, second day Rosh Chodesh. I see some of the fellas are still davening. I meant to tell everyone yesterday to bring breakfast to class. Say that in my shul they would shoot the chasm if it took as long as the chasm takes here. That much I can tell you. Shabbos morning, I could barely hear the chazan. I don't understand what kind of chazan you send up. They were mumbling. No one said forget the zimra properly. Suddenly you became a Yemenite shul. It was difficult to follow. Anyway, I just want to make one correction. Yesterday, Shia, I mentioned Genachatsky, who went with the Rav to Berlin, and I wasn't positive about his first name. This morning I picked up a Gemara that I believe he published, Dale HaMakarit, in the 1950s in Israel, and the name is Shlomo Yosef Genachatsky. And he was the Rav's Chaver in Berlin. So that's just a small correction on yesterday's Shia. Regarding our Shia here, I received a number of interesting emails. Rabbi Yisrael Herzog, now you should recognize who this is. Those of you who use the Art Scroll Rashi in English, he is the translator. And he was listening to the Shurim via the website. And he believes that the person who asked Professor Ginsberg whether you can use the elevator on Shabbat was Alexander Marx, Professor Alexander Marx. If I recall correctly, it's about 30 years since I read Eli Ginsberg's bio of his father, but I believe that in Ginsberg's biography, or biography of his father, it mentions that it was Alexander Marx. Now, he also mentions in relation to why quoted the Chazon Ish as saying to Professor Lieberman, why are you asking me Makorot? I should be asking you Makorot. And he cites a review by Rabbi Dr. Hillel Goldberg in tradition about the book that I cited in class by the two Talmidim of Professor Lieberman. And Hillel Goldberg claims that the Chazon Ish was being sarcastic. I have to tell you, I don't agree with that. I don't agree. If you're familiar with Hillel Goldberg's review, it was too sharp, it was too caustic, and it was not online. If you're going to take, if you're going to take the position that anyone who is associated with the seminary is not worth talking about him, not worth evaluating him, not worth trying to understand him, then of course we have to dismiss all the names I've mentioned. I think my position is rather more, is ethically sound, morally sound, halachically sound, hashkafically sound, because I think I'm ultimately going to come upon a very important halachic, hashkafic concept when all this is over. But I just want to mention I'm familiar with Hillel Goldberg's review, and I'd rather stand on the way I approach the topic than the way he did. The book I referred to in class, the biography of the biography of Professor Liebman by his two Talmidim, Shechet and Sparrow. Now, a very interesting email came in again from Rabbi Herzog, and he's listening to the Sheyur where I cite Saul Liebman and his students. I have a little story you may find interesting. This was told to me by Rav Mordechai Elefin Zatzal, whose first yahrzeit just passed. Now, those of you, the name Rav Mordechai Elefin, first of all, he's now related to me because my granddaughter-in-law, who was here Shabbat, is a great niece to Rav Mordechai Elefin. So her grandmother is an elephant. So now we're related. Rav Mordechai Elefin was a Talmud Mufak in a bar in Katla, and he built Itri. He came on Aliyah at a very early stage. You have no idea how important and how powerful he was at a certain time in the history of Torah in Jerusalem. And Rav Mordechai Elefin tells Rabbi Herzog the following story. And this is Mordechai Elefin about him. When he came to Israel in the mid-50s, he spent a lot of time with the Brisker Rav Zatzal. He was present at a Sheva Brachas of one of the Briska Rav's sons. There at the head table was sitting a guest from America, Professor Shaul Lieberman. Rav Elefin couldn't believe it. Shortly afterwards, he saw the Briska Rav on the street. He asked him, how could he honor someone like that? The Briska Rav answered, Mishpacha. So, if you're familiar with the Soloveitchik family, that answer makes a lot of sense. But it's a cute story, and you see that the Briska Rav had an attitude towards Professor Shaul Lieberman, more like Rakefet than my good friend and someone I greatly admire, Rabbi Dr. Hillel Goldberg. I can tell you one fascinating story about Rabbi Dr. Hillel Goldberg and yours truly. On the 100th anniversary yahrzeit of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, we had a public affair. One time Grus was alive, had public affairs, we were on the map. You fellas can't appreciate what we once were, and you can't understand how sad I am because of what we've become for the present time. So in memory of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, there were two speakers. Yours truly, I went to Yeshiva Salanter. I'm probably the only one who, from at least of American origins, that has a direct smicha from Yisrael Salanter. I have the only smicha that his Talmud's Talmud gave in the United States of America. It's a private smicha in addition to the YU smicha. So I was speaking about at this, and I was the first speaker, and I was speaking about the great impact Rabbi Yisrael's spiritual great-grandson, Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Kohen Lesson, had on me. Hillel Goldberg did a doctorate on Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. He was the next speaker. He got up and he said, I'm ready to faint. This, who made me into a great Jew? Who had great influence on me? Exactly the person that Harav Rakepet was just speaking about. So it turned out we both were under the great influence of, in my case, it was the Rav and Rav Lesson. In Hillel Goldberg's case, it was the Boston Rebbe and Rav Lesson. So it, what a small world that both of us should relate to the same Rebbe that evening. So I have great respect for Hillel Goldberg, but I see that the Briska Rav took my status rather than his. Now, one other comment, here more research has to be done because it's not really a correction. This is from someone named Henry Silverman. I've been listening to a lecture where you mentioned Dr. Judith Liebman having founded Shulamit School. In fact, she headed the school for many years, but the school's founding preceded her arrival in the United States. So it may very well be that Shulamit was on the map before Professor Lieberman's wife, Dr. Berlin Lieberman, got there. But one thing I can tell you as a fact, she was revered. She was the guiding spirit. I don't know whether Shulamit exists today. I have no idea what's happening in Brooklyn. You can correct me. I don't know if the world could handle the Shulamit today. But I recall that her picture was in the school, and it was like Rav Hirsch. When you walk into Choreg, you see Rav Hirsch's picture in Choreg there, and there you saw Professor Liebman's wife's picture. Okay, now I just want to go further. I also want to make a comment on Chinuch. So we spoke last week about Professor Liebman and Professor Heschel, the seminary. I made the comparison to Reb Aaron and Moriah Rebbe, Reb Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, and I stand on that comparison. I'm happy to hear that Reb Shmuel Soloveitchik said exactly the same thing. Baruch Shekivanti L'dap G'doylem, and remember, I'm talking about Reb Shmuel Soloveitchik, who certainly was a brother, and I trust knew his brothers extremely well. Now, in relation to Professor Heschel, I also stand on my comment, which, it sounds cute, but there's so much truth to it when you start to think how an individual who is so revered throughout the world and so well known, and the average intelligent Gentile, if you would ask him, Who do you know from the seminary faculty? They would say, Professor Heschel. And yet in the seminary, Professor Heschel, you know, was put down and looked down upon. Who was he? Ah, a little philosophy, a little theology, a little Hasidus. It doesn't come to the Talmud faculty. But, my dear students, that's life. It happens. Now, with Professor Heschel...
This is not correct. In reference to the average layperson. It may be true for the intellectual...
To say that, yes, right, you can, it doesn't matter. That's what I just said a second ago. You're just repeating me. Okay, it doesn't matter. I'm only giving a theory. I may be right, I may be wrong. But all I can tell you is this was the impression I had then, and this is the impression I have now. That chutz l'tochecheha beit medrash, Professor Heschel, everyone knew him. In the seminary, he had a deal with Professor Liebman and the Zamitrovsky and Sofer and all. And thank you for apologizing. But it doesn't matter, Michael, it doesn't matter. I may be wrong.
But the Talmud faculty can't be compared to the rest of the seminary.
No, but say...
A guttel in Talmud.
Right.
The only thing that exists is Talmud.
Right,
and nothing else exists.
And say they're not for Gedolim, not for the Rav, but for Professor Liebman, nothing else existed. You're absolutely right. So you're just supporting my theory, but within and without. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But what is important, just listen to me for 1 second now. So one thing I can tell you, that Professor Heschel, his writings are magnificent. And I know the 2 volumes I read of his, I mamish felt Yiret Shemayim, I felt such a kinship. And I saw with my Rebbeim, I mean, if the Rav said I'm jealous of him for one reason, halavai I could write the way he writes. And then I'm told the Rav said, I didn't hear with my own ears, but his son, my classmate, Dr. Grachis, you call him, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, has repeated this in the name of his father. And I told you about Rav Weiss. So one of the students sitting in front of me is a madrich in Torah Tshvaka, and a kid picked up one of the writings of Heschel, and some Rebbe saw him, told him, it's treif, it's possible, put it down. So I want to tell you something. Dafka, I went into my grandson's room on maybe Thursday of last week. And this is a grandson who's finished Tesda, third year university, already working, and I see he's reading Heschel. So I told them, do me a favor, when you finish it, I want to borrow it, I want to read it again to get an impression.
Which book?
The Earth is the Lord's, I believe. Very powerful. I read that many years ago, The Sabbath. Oh, he wrote so beautifully. So I want to tell you, if you're in Chinuch and you see a kid picking up Avram Yeshua's Heschel's books, and you're worried, you know what you would say? You know what I would say to the kid? Listen, after you finish reading it, let's discuss it and let's see what you got out of it. And let the kid know you're an address he can turn to if he has a question. But to my way of thinking, the worst thing in the world you can do is to tell a kid, put it down, you can't look at it. Because what happens, it's like we had Rebbeim in the yeshiva, and I was a Rosh Yeshiva, and we're teaching younger children, kids, teenage kids. So occasionally, a Rebbe skipped a Gemara that had, pardon me, sex in it. And I always took the attitude that's the worst thing a Rebbe can do. Because what does a healthy kid do? The Rebbe skipped the Gemara. He's going to go out of his way to take us on Sino in my days, today of course in Art Scroll, and see that Gemara. It's a million times better that the young man should learn it with the Rebbe and get a proper approach. Anyway, be it as it may, I ended off the class and I showed you the letter.
The reason why someone might tell a yeshiva student to put down Heschel was because Heschel taught at the seminary or because of the content?
No, because Heschel taught at the seminary. The Rebbe retracted?
Yeah.
So we got a clarification that the Rebbe retracted. He probably found out that he probably looked at Heschel. Okay, very good. I'm happy to hear that, because when you look at the writings, I told you, if Rav Yosef Weiss read Heschel, what more than that do you need? If the Rav said, I'm jealous of him, look at the way he writes. But anyway, one thing you see from all this clearly, that to go and dismiss these people at the seminary, you cannot do that. They meant well, and they were there, and you know, Professor Heschel There were certain circumstances. He was at Hebrew Union College first, then he comes to the seminary. And that letter I showed you from Reb Moshe to Louis Ginsburg about Reb Yitzchak Kuttner is classic. There is Reb Moshe writing to press at Ginsburg, please accept Rabbi Reb Yitzchak Kuttner, he's a big Talmud Chacham. And it shows you that there was a mixture here. It was caught together yet. Things had not crystallized. Things had not clarified.
Why didn't Heschel go to YU?
You see, the problem with YU, you can answer your own question. Ultimately, no one could pay a salary like JTS. And JTS was there. They taught a few hours a week. They had time to write, time for research. YU, in our time, show me one Rebbe who was given time to write. The only one who more or less had a schedule somewhat similar to JTS was the Rav, because the Rav came in Tuesday morning in our time and flew out Wednesday afternoon. You understand? So he was there a limited time, but it's not that the Rav wrote. He wrote a great deal, but not for publication. He wrote the manuscripts, which today all these books are flooding the world. Some are finished, some are unfinished, some are good, some are not on that level.
Is there more coming out?
I don't know. There'll be more. Now, gentlemen,
in my generation that grew up in the 60s and 70s,
right.
Heschel had more of an impact
right.
than the entire Yeshiva University faculty combined,
right. no,
including at the time the Rav.
You're absolutely right. Believe me, the New York Times knew Heschel. It didn't discover the Rav till the mid-70s. You're
absolutely later than that.
No, the mid-70s. No, this I'm telling you, outside of the seminary, no one equaled the impact of Professor Avram Yehoshua Heschel. I can still see him standing with Martin Luther King. I can still see a picture of him putting on a yarmulke. He's about to make a bracha on a glass of water. You're right.
But his writings about Shabbat, his writings about
Israel, writings, right? His writings about Torah Shabbat Peh, the Hasidus, the feeling, there are no two ways about it. You're absolutely right.
No one has written a book about Israel. That's Heschel.
Okay, you're absolutely. Let me just think for a minute. Did anyone equal Heschel in writing about Israel?
Israel the Eternal.
Herman Wouk.
What?
Echo of Eternity.
Herman Wouk in his second book is also excellent on Israel. The one that came out a few years ago.
Not as poetic.
No one could write like Heschel. Look, if the Rav said what he said, what do you want out of me? Mendel, before I go further, I'm moving into the world of halacha. Yeah, what did you want to ask anything?
No, that's fine.
Okay. With all this being said, the seminary faculty had moved more right wing. As I told you last week, Mordechai Kaplan was persona non grata. By the time they got him to retire at 75, if you read Mordechai Kaplan's diary, he was bitter at what happened at the seminary. But as much as the seminary moved more right-wing and had a faculty where essentially everyone was Shoyma Torah and Mitzvot and Shoyma Shabbos, and many said proudly they were Orthodox, what was happening out in the big world could not be controlled by the seminary faculty. And here you come back to dual culture. And it comes back to the Divrei Torah of the Rav that I've said over and repeated so many times, Ger v'tosha v'nochi imachem. All of us in this room, in this institution, in this world, live in two worlds. Willy-nilly, whether we like it or not, we are Jews, we are human beings. We're part of a greater culture around us. There's no concept of a ghetto today. Could very well be that in the Middle Ages, a Jew lived in a ghetto, and a Jew had very little culture of the world surrounding him. I can tell you about my grandfather, who lived with me and whom I knew very well and took me to shul on Shabbos, although I used to drive him crazy because on the way to shul, I always, you know the Bronx, but Washington Avenue is where all the shuls were, and I lived on Washington Avenue about three blocks away from where the shuls began. Then there was one shul after another, and on the way there, I always detoured for 2 minutes. When I came to Tremont and Washington, I went into Tremont about four stores in, and there was a bridal shop owned by Hank Greenberg's aunt and uncle. And in the window was a picture of hammering Hank Greenberg of the Detroit Tigers to my dear aunt and uncle with their names. Much success in your bridal shop, your loving nephew, Henry Hank, in quotation marks, Greenberg's, written in green ink. Greenberg, green ink. So Shabbos morning, there was a special kiyum of seeing that picture of Hank Greenberg. It used to drive my grandfather crazy. When I tell you about my grandfather, he grew up in, let's figure out, that grandfather came from the Minsk area, Grodno Minsk. So he grew up in White Russia, came to America, let's say at 15, 16, he came at the turn of the last century, 1900. He didn't know how to speak Russian. All he knew was Yiddish. And he was totally ghettoized, you understand? And perhaps that was possible when you lived in a ghetto. But today we step out in the big world, whether we like it or not. Lakewood is in the big world, and Muncie's in the big world, and Sakma's in the big world. I don't know, maybe you can make an argument in Meir Sharim, the Rabaralas, and that ilk, the Eidah Charei did. To a certain degree, they're not influenced by the big world. And by the way, this is why Balei Tshuva tend to be so extreme, because they want to get away from the big world that corrupted them, that groomed them, that turned them into Mechallelei Shabbos, that groomed their grandparents, their parents, etc., their siblings. They want to get away from it, so they become more and more extreme, and you run back into time and build a ghetto around yourselves. And even there, I'm not certain you can build a ghetto today. There's internet, and there are posters, and there's or these new miracle phones that everyone carries around. I mean, you can get news on them, you can get television on them, you get movies on them. Ribbono shel Olam, what people have today is beyond words. So it's very hard to say you live in a ghetto today. And today we all have dual identity. The fact that we speak English, the fact that we speak Hebrew, the fact that we can relate to general philosophy, world philosophy, Jewish philosophy, and on a very simple level, we are all human beings. We go to hospitals, we fight cancer, we fight heart disease, we fight illness, we rejoice in medical advancement. So we're all part of these two worlds. And this is the Rav's Divrei Torah, where Avraham Avinu says to the Bnei Chay, Gev Toshav Anochi Machem. And the Rav says, all of us on one hand are Gerim, that we have to retain a different way of life, a different lifestyle. And you know the Rav's famous story on the plane, a story he told so many times, that he was sitting on the plane coming to New York from Boston. And you know, in those days, only intelligent people flew. To fly, you needed money. And generally speaking, these were successful people and intelligent people. And he's sitting next to faculty members of Harvard and top quality people. And he's preparing a drasha he has to give at Maria Tuesday night. And he notices the man sitting next to him. He's a very intelligent, elegant, non-Jewish person. And he looks over and he says, "Pardon me, Rabbi, why do you write that way? Why do you write from, look, Hebrew, English, difference in writing. You're writing from right to left. Why don't you write from left to right the way we all do?" And the Rav understood at that moment these were cultures in conflict. This is Ger Anochi Machem. On the other hand, we're Toshavim. We're flying together with Gentiles. We're taking advantage of modern technology. We read the New York Times. We discuss issues. We vote in the elections. And we live in two worlds. And the question, the challenge is how to balance out these two worlds. I just heard a drasha from the Rav from the 1950s, Saturday night in Boston, where the Rav speaks about the difference between a ha and a sadeh. That there's one thing to be from when you live, Yaakov Ishtam Yeshev Ohalim, that is very easy. The challenge is to be from when you're in Ish Sadeh, when you're out there on the battlefield, the battle lines, when you're living among the Gentiles, when you're living in a culture, in a civilization, in technology, and then to be from, this is a tremendous challenge. For the Jews to be from in an ohel, not that difficult. But when you go down to Egypt and you have the most modern technology, the most advanced civilization, and there Yosef HaTzadik can retain his Yiddishkeit, he can have Ephraim and Menashe, this is the achievement. So this
we have to go back to
America? No.
We have to admire Jews in America who haven't made Aliyah.
As I said, Shabbos, that's a step towards Aliyah. Baruch Hashem. It's the old battle we had about Russia. Do we try to influence them to be Jews in Russia or try to influence them to make Aliyah? And the answer, in my opinion, was you have to influence them to be Jews. And once you have more Jews, you'll have more Aliyah ultimately. But we have to admire Jews. And in Israel, too, we have these tremendous challenges. We're living in two worlds here, more than in America. Because here you have a tremendous left wing and the Haaretz and the pace setters. We haven't yet conquered all. We're getting there. It's a lot better than it was. Kashra here is a real problem. Halavai, we had to know you. But anyway, be it as it may, outside of the seminary, the Jew from Eastern Europe was now a third, fourth generation. The influence was overwhelming. And they were more and more and further removed from Yiddishkeit. And the pressure on the rabbinical assembly was real, tangible. And this is what happened in 48. They established a committee on Jewish law, 23 members, and for the first time, unlike Hoshin Mishpat, unlike anything we were ever taught, unlike anything we ever paskin, you could ask a shaila and you could get as many as three or four different answers. And as long as three rabbis gave the answer, you could follow the opinion you wanted. Generally speaking, the majority followed a minority opinion, and the minority of conservative Jews followed the majority opinion. And you'll understand in a minute when I start to give examples. Now, an article appeared about this, probably the best article you can get your hands on, is in the 1975-1976 Encyclopedia Judaica Yearbook. Let me say a few words about the Judaica, because for you it's ancient history already, for me it brought me an Aliyah. In Germany in the 1930s, they began a tremendous project that may have begun as early as 29 already, to come out with a tremendous Judaica, a German encyclopedia of everything you want to know about Judaism. If I'm not mistaken, the editor at a certain point was Nachum Goldman in Germany. You can check me out. I may be wrong, but that's what my memory tells me. About 8 volumes came out, and Hitler came to power. That was the end, of course, of the Judaica. After the war, at a certain point, the reparations from Germany, they kept on getting more money and more money. The reparations itself, we've discussed, it's a whole question. Should we have taken reparations from Germany? All right, it's a different question. It's a question that hangs fire. But as I've told you more than once, anyone who portrays Moriah Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, as a dove doesn't know what he's talking about, because on the reparations issue, he was 1,000,000% opposed with such vigor and such firmness at that time.
Not certain he changed.
Many decades later. Many decades later. Yitzhak, you're always running ahead. Many decades later, the Rav said, maybe I was wrong in being so stridently opposed. With that money, they built the state, they built institutions, they were able to absorb the Aliyah that came here from the Arab countries, the displaced persons from the Ashkenazic countries, etc., etc. Now, the Judaica got special funding from Germany to continue and put it out, this time in English. It was decided to do it in English because until today, there are more Jews in the world to read English than read Hebrew and understand. In other words, there may be more Jews who read Hebrew as their prayers, but they don't really understand them. But as far as the international language, when there are international conferences, you will know that the language that is used until today is English, not Hebrew. So certainly in the 1960s, they decided to put out the Judaica in English.
Not just Jews.
It doesn't matter, but it's a book, it's the Judaica, the Encyclopedia Judaica, it's about Jews. Now, the Judaica. Now, the money came to the Israeli government, and the government began this project. Like anything else, we all know when government funding is involved, nothing gets off the floor rapidly. there is bureaucracy, you're getting your salary anyway, to use ancient Chinese, medafsif nisht iba arbitin, you don't have to work too hard. Those of you who could go back in time with me and see communist Russia, I can give you a very simple example. Communist Russia, I'll never forget, in the hotel, the Beryuska, the store for foreign currency, if it closed for lunch at 1 o'clock to three o'clock, by 20 to 1, they didn't let anyone into the store. It's their government employees. They're going to get paid anyway. What do we got to work hard for? So the same thing happened with the Judaica. It went here, it went there, it sputtered there. Finally, the government sold it off to private people, kept the publishing. When it went into the hands of private people, they got very serious about it. And beginning with about 68, it went into very high gear following the Six-Day War, and the encyclopedia was published in the early 70s. Now, for the first few years, they came out with yearbooks. And every yearbook had special articles. It was like a Britannica yearbook. The one of 75, 76, beginning on page 149, has a tremendous article on conservative halachic decisions and enactments. The author of the article is Theodore Friedman. Now, when we talk about Theodore Friedman, let me just say a few words about him, because he's going to play a very big role in today's Sheyua. Theodore Friedman was a yeshiva boy, went to Reitz on the east side of New York, and grew up in an Orthodox home, in an Orthodox environment, later went on to JTS, and was a graduate of the Jewish Theological Seminary. His most famous rabbinate, where he was for many years, was in South Orange, Bethel. It was a very powerful conservative congregation. The more traditional of the two that were in Maplewood, South Orange, there was Louis Levitsky, who was a Reconstructionist, but Teddy Friedman was not a Reconstructionist. He was a mainline conservative rabbi. Later becomes president of the Rabbinical Assembly and was one of the key rabbis in the Committee on Jewish Law. And he wrote the article, and he gave many, many examples. Now, for instance, you'll see from the questions what was bothering the Jews out there in the Sadeh. What about the seventh day of Tammuz, the ninth of Ab, the 3 weeks, marriage.
It wasn't bothering it was bothering the leadership.
It was bothering the rabbis because the people, I'm going to come to the important ones at the end, the most important one I want to do in depth, I'm going to do it at the very end, but relax, this is one of the first examples he gives. What are we talking about? Why is this a problem? My dear student, it's very simple. When do you get married? Most people don't get married during the winter. They get married, June begins the month of weddings. The summer is magnificent for weddings. The weather is good. You can go on a honeymoon. The weather is better. You're not going to freeze. What does the Jew out in the Sadeh know about the 3 weeks? Michael, this is what you were trying to say.
Zero.
How many conservative Jews know about Zion B'Tammuz? Maybe when it comes to Tisha B'Av, you'll run a slightly higher percentage out there in the Sadeh. So then they came to the rabbis, and they bothered the rabbis, we want to get married, and Nebuch, this conservative rabbi, has to tell them, it's the 3 weeks. What do you mean it's the 3 weeks? What's straightening a cup? Who ever heard of the 3 weeks? So the Committee on Jewish Law, and one of the opinions that came in, that on Yud Zion Tammuz and Tisha B'Av itself, you cannot make a wedding. But until the 9 days, you can make any type of wedding. No, David, what are they depending upon? This is supposed to be al pi halacha, the Shulchan Aruch, Svadim. What problem do they have? Didn't Rabbi Ovadia Yosef go crazy boasting that when I became chief rabbi in Tel Aviv, I told the Ashkenazim to go fly a kite? Until Rav Avadja became chief rabbi, no one in Tel Aviv could get married during the 3 weeks. And Rav Avadja became chief rabbi. He said, if the Ashkenazim want to follow the Ramah and not get married, that's their business. Don't interfere with the Sfadim. And he permitted Sfadim to get married until the 9 days, as is in accordance with the halacha. So the conservative... Excuse me? I can't hear. You can even I was going to say you can even make a case that Shavuot Shechal Bo Tisha B'Av, until then you can get married, and you can even make a case when Tisha B'Av falls on Sunday, is there a Shavuot Shechal Bo Tisha B'Av altogether? See, if it's a nitche, it's a whole machlekes achronim. If Sunday is really Tisha B'Av, there's no Shavuot Shechal Bo. But if Shabbos is Tisha B'Av and it's a nitche, could be you can make a case. There is a Shavuot Shechal Bo, could be not. So machlokes achronim. But you see, the conservative movement, all right, have a malas mach. We all became svadim. Halavai, every Jew besadeh should observe according to the Shulchan Aruch. Give me one more second. However, small weddings, either at home in the rabbi's study, may be held until Tisha B'Av itself. So you see, right away you can see the breakdown. And this was not the majority opinion. This was a minority, but it was more than three rabbis. Many rabbis out in the field now had a source. They quoted the Committee on Jewish Law. These are learned rabbis. This is what they paskin. Right? Minor example. We'll come to a more major one in 1 second.
What
yes.
Year was that?
He doesn't give the year when the tribal was written. But in my educated guess, this has to be in the 1950s already. You follow? Because they started, the Committee on Jewish Law is reconstructed in 53. I would imagine this tshuva is from the 50s. You follow? This is a problem that has to come up right away. It's not something.
This is the committee of the RA, not the seminary.
Of the RA. The seminary never had a committee. Seminary, you went to Rav Shaul Liebman, you asked for a psak.
There were faculty members on the law.
There were some faculty members, but it was mainly practicing rabbis. I'll give you a name in a second, you'll get an idea of who we're talking about.
Which volume?
This was the 74 to 75 year book. Unfortunately, we don't have it upstairs. If we had it upstairs, I could. 75 to 76, excuse me. 1975, 1976, beginning on page 149. What I just quoted to you is on page. Page 150. You have it. You have it, Michael. Okay.
I mean, that's some of those early years.
If you have some, if you have it, bring it to class so we can show the class.
Just wanted to know, does Lieberman and the more conservative faculty members protest and scream at this?
We'll come to that. We'll come to that. No, on a question like this, Lieberman did not protest. Yesh hamila smoch the Shulchan Aruch to say that. But you're going to see in a moment where we go further. Yes?
Just something, when he says small weddings held in rabbi's study, that's 1950s code words for weddings that they want to speed up, that they have to...
Well, you could, and that is just the code words. A rabbi in Israel was once in the newspapers, he says, in North Tel Aviv, I'm not a Masada Kedushin unless the kala has a stomach, has a beten malay. So, that's part of life. God have mercy, God have mercy. On the other hand, thank God, again, as my grandchildren said, at least it's men and women. We're living in a time where God have mercy on us. The Sader, or the Toshav, is tremendous influence. Now, then you come to a much more major problem. And this is a problem, of course, that haunts us. And every rabbi in the field feels this problem. When people are not religious, so you're a Kohen, so what if you're a Kohen? What does it mean to be a Kohen? No, you go to university. Jews are accepted all over. You fall in love with a wonderful Gentile girl. Jewish women have no monopoly on goodness, can be a Gentile girl, fabulous girl, devoted to you, a decent human being. And she wants to convert. She wants to get married. She wants to be a Jew. Now, it's not my lectures on gay right now. Don't shoot at me the Mishnah and Yavama that how can you marry the whole sugi and Yavama, how can you marry someone for the sake of marriage? But Bismarck is there, we make you. Fine. Zman is we make here, we take a b'diavad and we live with it. Fine. It's one problem, it's a kohen. He doesn't even know he's a kohen. The Rav tells the story of his first wedding in America, where he, I have this in my book, by the way, I'm pretty sure, where he asked the chatan, are you a kohen, a levi, or Israel? The chatan looks at him, didn't know what he was asking. He finds out he's a kohen. The Rav tells the famous story. Many years later, in 1975, it appears in the new book. What's it called? Divrei HaRav. What's the Reb Heschel's new book? Reb Heschel Shechter. Divrei HaRav. It appears in Divrei HaRav. I can show it to you. The Rav tells the famous story of this young lady who sought out Yiddishkeit on her own and fell in love with this. It's in my book too, Baruch Hashem, with an assimilated Jewish boy in graduate school. And she made the boy from. And after she makes the boy from, the boy wants to discover his roots. He goes to the cemetery outside of Boston where his grandparents are buried. And what does he find, Yitzchak? On the tombstone. The split, McKeesport, Pennsylvania. Say that whatever I have is correct in the book, not in my book. And he finds the symbol of the hand split, the Birchat Kanim. No, he's a Kohen, she's a Giyorit, she made him from. And the Rav tells them there's nothing he can do, they can't get married. Okay, and then this problem, what? And I didn't have it in the rabbinate, Mendel. I didn't have it in the rabbinate with this couple, I can remember until today. And what could I do? So,
one second,
we're talking. So here you have a member of the Committee on Jewish Law, Rabbi Isaac Klein. Rabbi Isaac Klein, I believe it was in Baltimore. Baltimore, upstate New York. Now what am I talking about? He was in Albany. In Baltimore is Maryland. Sorry, Erev Hapashia. He was. I knew he was in upstate New York. So you say he was in Albany. He was the Rav in Albany. Rabbi Isaac Klein was an Ungarish Talmud Chacham. They tell me he was a first-rate Talmud Chacham.
Buffalo.
I knew it was with a B. All right. Buffalo. Baruch Hashem. I knew it was with a B. Thank you. Buffalo. I knew it was upstate New York. Buffalo. That's what I wanted to hit. Okay. They tell me Isaac Klein was a first-rate Talmud Chacham. An Ungarish Talmud Chacham. Bucky and Chupat. And he was had come to America and became a conservative rabbi. And he was a big lamdan. I don't believe it was a seminary graduate. I believe he came already with smicha from the old country. And he went crazy, wrote a whole tshuva that why can't the kohen marry a giyoret? Because isha zona, right? V'chalala, etc. Lo yitachu, a zona. So I've explained to you more than once that the word zonar in Torah literature, in Torah language, in the Torah sprach, does not mean a prostitute. We use it today for a harlot. Zona is a concept that means a non-Jewish woman, and a kohen cannot marry a zonar. By rabbinic interpretation of the verse, first of all, that's a machlokes rishonim, whether it's rabbinic or Torah. Most Rishonim hold its Torah law. A female proselyte, I'm quoting now from Rabbi Klein, is classed as a harlot of a woman or a woman of loose morals. Such continued prohibition, Rabbi Klein writes, constitutes a chilul Hashem, since we cannot consider our non-Jewish neighbors as people of loose moral sexual practices. Nu Shmuel, is that a halachic? Is that a halachic consideration? Harlot, Lusa, this is the influence of the New York Times. This is the influence of Sadeh. This is the influence of Toshav. And then he goes into Lumbus. Then he adds on, and this is a halachic factor. Moreover, the authenticity of the status of a coin is at best doubtful. No one has a total chazaka. Then he goes even further. Finally, quis Christians or Mohammedans cannot be regarded as idolaters and idolaters. In other words, this is the old viewpoint, going back to the Meiri, that we cannot consider our non-Jewish neighbors today Oved Avodah Zarah. And he was Mater, a Kohen, marrying the Diyaret. Yes, the children were not Kohanim, they were Halalim, they were regular Israelites, but he was Matil Lachatchila for this marriage. And this was, again, a minority opinion. The majority went properly, but this was the opinion that caught on. I had this exact problem in the rabbinate where I get a call, I remember the name until today, we're talking on the 50 years ago, if not 50 years ago. I get home from YU, gave my shir, come back to my kehillah. My wife says a Mrs. Palhemus called. She said it's very important. Palhemus, I hab noch nicht gehört, I yitzel heißen Palhemus. I called this lady, a fancy area. I was rabbi in a fancy suburb at the time. This maybe with South Orange. South Orange was the seventh wealthiest community, Fortune magazine in the mid-60s. Seventh wealthiest community in America, and Maplewood was the 15th wealthiest. And I was rabbi right at the edge, one block into Maplewood, one block away from the famous South Orange Columbus High School, which was the top high school in New Jersey at the time. That's where George went to Seinfeld frame, a thing. So, a point of identity. So, fine, I call her back. A daughter is marrying a yeshiva boy, a Brooklyn boy going to Teachers Institute in YU. And fine, I meet with them, wonderful, good, and everything. I give my president permission to have the wedding in the shul, a local wedding, and we have a garden around it. There'll be a collation and everything. And a few days before the wedding, I get a call from Brooklyn from the rabbi who converted her, and an elder rabbi from the Yerush Rabbanim is going to be Masada Kedushin. And he says to me, "Ravrot kaf chada problem. Ich kann nicht sein mesadik kedushin, but if she ich can't yet sein mesadik kedushin. I can't be mesadik kedushin, but maybe you can." I say, "What's the problem?" He said, "He's preparing the ketuvah, and he found out the boy is a kohen." So I say to him, "If you can't be mesadik kedushin, how can I?" He says, "But you're from Yeshiva University, and dat nis memem mekiel." Oh my gosh, what he let me fall into! That I have aggravation. So a conservative rabbi over in East Orange was Masada Kedushin, and under the chuppah he said that Rabbi Rothkopf, or Dr. Rothkopf, I believe he said doctor, I already had a doctorate, is cruel. Okay, so here, fine, this is Rabbi Isaac Klein. Then you go one step further. Forget about a Kohen and a Giyoret. That is rare. But what about a Kohen and a Grusha? And here, just think logically. Here you see the direct conflict. Ksade Faha, Ger V'Toshav. What's wrong with a Grusha? She got married young. She didn't have good judgment. The man she married was an Oisvav, was a bum. She was young, she was in love, she didn't understand. Years ago. She's not worth a second chance. She can't have a second try. She's in love today. She's much older, mature, a wonderful man, a good woman. They're made for each other. Why can't they get married? So he's a Kohen. So what? The pressure was unbelievable. And here you have a responsum that was written by a Rav, I can tell you in his own personal life, was a total Shomer Shabbos. You may recognize the name. It was a very famous name in the conservative movement, Rabbi Benzin Buxa. Do you recognize? You remember the siddur he put out? Wasn't that the one they used for many years? Wrote on Rav Kook. I believe that was his doctorate. And I know that he was from. I know this from eyewitnesses. He in his own life was a Shomer Shabbos. Quote what we must accept. I'm quoting him. We must accept the fact too that an unequivocal condemnation of such marriage and an unwillingness to officiate may present Judaism as arbitrary and indifferent to personal happiness. I mean, you listen to these words. When I, with Yiddishkeit, the first thing you have to tell a kid at the age of one is that Torah Hashem Tamima. And that comes ahead of everything else. The Western world, Judaism may be beautiful, but personal happiness? I heard a yeshiva, an ex-yeshiva boy who took his yarmulke off and became an oisvach in his 50s. I heard him tell his daughter, you should do whatever you want in life and marry whoever you want, Jew or non-Jew. The main thing in life is your personal happiness. Here it is. I heard this with my own ears from an MTA graduate. And listen to this. And as placing legal formalism above human values. No, you haven't heard that before? Legal formalism? Over a coin to a grusha? You're going to cause these people so much heartache? With the result that such people would be driven to leave the synagogue and Jewish observance generally. Wow. We're going to lose them. No, we're going to lose them. What can I do? But here, you're going to lose them? And then he quotes Rabbi Reuben's Lumbus. B'di'evet, if they get married, isn't the Kedushin Tovsim? It's Chai Veilatin, right? It's not an Issacharit, it's not an Issamitat Beitin. Noting further that halakhically such marriage is valid, though a get is indicated since it violates a biblical prohibition. Yeah, a get you need, absolutely. Even though it may be asa, the authors of the responsum write that the officiating rabbi must inform the Kohen that his offspring from such marriage will lose the status of Kohen. Moreover, such weddings should be held in the privacy of the home or the rabbi's study. Okay? When a Kohen, the reception can be a big reception afterwards. He wants the kids to be gone. You know the story of the guy who came to the rabbi, offered him $1,000, make me a Kohen, this and that. Why do you want to be a Kohen? Because my father was a Kohen, my grandfather was a Kohen. I'm Ratzon Chogeget, but Atkedei Kach, it's not human happiness. But what a tshuva coming from Ben Zion Baksa. So you see, once again, it's the minority opinion, but the minority opinion that carries the day. Kohanim, Grushot, Giorot, etc. Oh, my dear friends, I lived. The next one is unbelievable, unbelievable. No? How many of you rabbinated in the Philadelphia area in the 1960s, 50s into the 60s? Gentlemen, Philadelphia, Irva Ein B'Yisrael. There were more Jews in Philadelphia at the time than in Chicago or than Los Angeles.
300,000.
It was a mob scene, Philadelphia. My own family, 4 Rothkopf brothers came to America in 1900. One wound up in Massachusetts, that was my great uncle. One wound up in New York, that was my grandfather. 2 wound up in Philadelphia. Just think for one moment. No, did you ever use the mikveh in Philadelphia? God have mercy on
Logan.
You. Logan was the second mikveh. I'm talking about South Philadelphia. But Logan already was luxury. The Gemara talks about Rabbi Yochanan, right, that he sat outside the mikveh, that when the women came out, they should look at him and have children like him. When you came out of the mikveh in South Philadelphia, you were in an old YMHA. The neighborhood was completely Afro-American. All over, you didn't see a Jewish face, just the lowlives of Philadelphia society sitting there, playing cards, playing checkers. 50s into the, my wife went, don't tell me, I know what I'm talking about. And the first, these were the faces you saw. So a big Talmud Chacham said, it's no wonder that a frum kid never came out of Philadelphia. Because even if the women went to mikveh, instead of seeing Rabbi Yochanan, who did they see? Making comments on the Jewish girlies as well. It was unbelievable what Philadelphia was. Then they finally built a mikveh in Logan. I was at the dedication of that mikveh, Dr. Askowitz, there were a few isolated tzaddikim in Philadelphia. This had to be 62 when the mikveh was dedicated. It was like a great moment. Within 5 years, that area was so bad, women were afraid to go there, let alone by day, certainly not by night. Everyone went to the mikveh in Camden, which was in a better neighborhood across the bridge. Anyway, now what do you do now with conversion? No, what did the conservative movement come up with? You can go to a swimming pool. And many of the conversions in the greater Philadelphia area, where the women did go to a body of water, the body of water was a swimming pool.
They all went as a group.
Here. The second major decision in committee in regard to the ritual requirement for conversion relates to the permissibility of using a swimming pool as a valid ritualarium or mikvah. A Hebrew response among the question by Rabbi Benjamin Z. Kreitman, he was a fine conservative rabbi, adopted by the committee, concludes with the decision that, quote, where no sanitary, aesthetic-appearing mikveh is available, a swimming pool located in a building operated by a Jewish communal agency may be used. So now, just think for
so
one...
tell me the reason why.
What do you mean the reason why?
Why was that? Why would this become an issue?
Because they didn't have a mikveh that was
decent. No, the Orthodox wouldn't allow.
No, and Philadelphia, please, gentlemen, don't confuse Chicago with Philadelphia. In Philadelphia, there was no Orthodox. They were the happiest people in the world to allow women to use the mikveh. There was no mikveh. The mikveh was a disgrace. The mikveh was, they called Rav Hirsch when he came to Frankfurt, I'm calling Rav Hirsch now, that when I came to Frankfurt on my 1851, not only didn't he have a minion Shomer Shabbos, not only didn't he have a minion who put on tefillin, but he described the mikveh located, I'm quoting, in an alleyway fit for the passage of swine, end quote. That was the mikveh in Philadelphia.
The Logan mikveh was a functioning mikveh, certainly.
Logan is long after this tshuva was written. This tshuva was written in the 50s. It had nothing to do with Logan. But you mean they stopped them from using Logan, the mikveh? Could be. By then there's a swing to the right.
What were they referring to in terms of in the 50s?
Ah, the YMHA had a swimming pool. The conversions in Philadelphia were done in the YMHA. There they had a swimming pool.
Yeah, you're sure this is from the 50s?
I'm positive. When he describes here, when he describes, where was I? The other page.
The controversy was with Beth Shalom.
Where no sanitary, aesthetic, appearing mikvahs available, a swimming pool located in a building operated by a Jewish communal agency may be used. He's talking about the YMCA. He's talking about the swimming pool, and this went on all over America where there was not a mikveh on a standard that a conservative matron would feel at home in, period.
But again, do you have a date for this?
No, there's no date here, but this response, if I can see one after another, they're all out of the 1950s. They're all out of the early development of conservative Judaism at that time, the 50s. Excuse me?
They're talking about Giyur.
What conservative woman went to mikveh? They never heard of mikveh. Talking about Giyur, they're talking about the rabbis never and their problems. Where do you do a Geira? I remember in Philadelphia, in my time, I think it was twice a year, they had a public affair where all the converts went to mikveh together in a loose-fitting bathing suit, quote, end quote. But that's before Logan. Interesting. It's interesting to me. Logan, they didn't let the conservative use it?
I'm not sure when. It became an issue, certainly. It has, when the swimming pool.
No, it has to be much later.
Chicago
was the cause celebre.
And
Chicago, a volume came out last year, Cold Gris, where you have the whole story with all the gut feeling that evolved out of that controversy in Chicago. But Chicago was a different story, but that's much later. Here it's Bashir talking about the mikveh in South Philadelphia was a disgrace. Did you ever see what mikvot were like in Yerushalayim? Today it's a different city, Baruch Hashem. Today they're rebuilding the mikveh in Rehavia. Today they have a mikveh for invalids that the late Rabbi Kowalski, Zeichel says, Zichrono Lebracha, built. You have to give credit. When my daughter moved into Katamon, she led the battle. They refurbished the mikveh in Katamon. That's a very nice mikveh today.
One question. So in this article, no dates were given?
No. That could be in the footnotes. I don't have the footnotes in front of me. Bring in. I try to get the original copy. I can't get it. Excuse me? Bring in the original trib and we'll see.
In terms of the history of these issues,
right,
the dating is really
I'm willing to, my educated guess, this is out of the 50s, okay? Because I know when the article on writing comes out, we'll see. Right, and these are all from that era. And I'm leaving the driving. Yeah, I'm going to quote from Waxman, but I'm leaving the driving to the end because that's the most important.
There was about 50 years before then, there was a rabbi in New York, I forget his name, who had a whole sefer that the water in New York at least could be considered water for a mikvah, even though it was coming from upstate.
You're talking about Rabbi David Miller, nothing to do with our Rav David Miller. You're talking about a man who had lived in Slabodka Yeshiva. You're talking about a man who went into business in Oakland, in the furniture business, I believe, and did very well, became quite wealthy, and devoted his life to giving out free, which I have, maybe Yitzchak has it, two books, one on the secret of a Jew and one on the secret of happiness. One dealt with Shabbat and one dealt with mikvah. And then he gave out a pamphlet, How to Build a Mikvah in Your House. And you're right, there was something there with using the regular water system, how to be makshia. He was not accepted lahalacha. But this is dealing purely, again, his own words, he is dealing with a mikvah that is aesthetically appealing. And you couldn't take a woman to the South Philadelphia mikvah if she's converting, so they used this swimming pool. And that was well known in Philadelphia, and it was a tshuva of Kreitman.
Now, Rabbi Mendel over this small tshuva.
Yeah.
That a woman could go in a non-tight bathing suit.
Yeah, I understand.
And she needs to go to mikvah for a mikvah, say
that. If it's a non-tight bathing suit, b'di'evit, I heard a similar story in Baltimore, but that's a b'di'evit. Okay. Now, another question that came up, which is a question that haunts the conservative movement until today, is the whole question of the Yontif Sheni. Now, this question is a fascinating question because here, there are two factors that exacerbate the very question. One, of course, is the fact that whoever heard of Yom Tov Sheni, it's hard enough to observe Yom Tov Rishon. I don't have to tell you, most American Jews never heard of Shavuot. If you know Balei Tshuva, talk with them, so you'll find out every American Jew heard of Pesach. Pesach has mazel because you can't eat chametz, you have to eat matzah. Matzah becomes a big seller. Even the New York Times writes about matzah and kosher wine for Pesach. Everyone heard of it. Sukkot has mazel, it's after Yom Kippur. So even though I would announce that Leil Ne'ilah, I would make an announcement that the shul will meet again on Rosh Hashanah next at such and such a date and such a time, it was tongue-in-cheek. But everyone in shul knew that, all right, after Yom Kippur, there'll be another big holiday, Sukkot, and then we can forget about Judaism for the rest of the year. Sukkot also has mazel, because you build a sukkah, dalet minim. These are things people talk about. Occasionally, again, it reaches the press of the Sader, the press of the Toshav, the New York Times suddenly will zero in on where the Etrogan come from, the American government had to make a special ruling this year that you don't have to check Etrogan, that they should be allowed in. You know what I'm talking about, at point of entry, you don't have to quarantine it, etc., etc. So if you read in the New York Times about Lulav and Etrog, so you know there's a Chag of Sukkot. Shavuot no one knows about. And Shavuot has no ceremony. If it has no ceremony, why should anyone know about it? To add to the distress of the conservative movement, the Reform only observed one day. All of us know we have a calendar today. I have a calendar face. 100 years from now, I can tell you when the Chagim will fall. So that's one part of the problem. Why observe Yom Tov Sheni? The second part, of course, and that becomes more tense as every year moves on, or more intense as every year moves on, is that Baruch Hashem, we have a state of Israel today. We have planes going back and forth. We have endless individuals who celebrate Yom Tov in Israel. And every Jew who has ever visited Israel for a Chag knows that in the state of Israel, the frumest Jews observe only one day Yom Tov. I once recall in 69, working the encyclopedia, one of the women working there asked me for a psak for her grandmother who was visiting and wanted to know what to do Yom Tov Sheni. So like a good yeshiva boy, Talmud Chacham, Talmud of the Rav, I gave a psak of a day and a half. You know what Allah Lamdis, the girl understood. She had learned, as a graduate of Stern College, I believe. And she told her grandmother, so after Yom Tov, I asked her what happened. She said, well, her grandmother came out of the hotel on Yom Tov Sheni. She saw Hasidim getting onto buses. She said, what? I'm going to observe Yom Tov Sheni? What am I, crazy? Here I see Hasidim in long bekishes with beaten prayers, getting, in those days no one had a car yet, getting onto buses. What kind of Yom Tov Sheni is there here? And that was the end of her day and a half lechumra. Matan, I want to talk to you, please let me know what happened, okay? Okay. Now, so Yom Tov Sheni really is a problem for the conservative movement. I don't have to tell you. If you're a rabbi out of town, I still recall on Shavuos, we had difficulty putting together a big service. It took a long time till we could get an atmosphere of Shavuos into the shul. Pesach, Sukkot, Mela. Shavuos, you're dead. And this was an Orthodox shul. All right, but we were out of the mainstream. You can imagine Yom Tov Sheni. When it comes to Yom Tov Sheni, there were like 3-4 different psukim. And I got to tell you, I reckon, for instance, one psak was written by Rabbi Philip Siegel and Abraham, Rabbi Siegel and Abraham Ehrlich. You remember these rabbanim? Philip Siegel was well known. Now, in their conclusion, the authors made the observance of the second day of the festival a matter to be decided by the local rabbi. To quote their conclusion, quote, while we reaffirm the inherent value of Yom Tov Sheni in order to provide relief to those who no longer find in it spiritual enrichment, and to those for sociological, economic reasons find it not feasible to observe the second day of Yom Tov, we declare that Yom Tov Sheni is not a chok, a permanent enactment, but a minhag. Accustomed congregations need not feel to observe other than the second day of Rosh Hashanah. So could you imagine?
Whose opinion was that?
Siegel and Ehrlich. They wrote that Shuvah. And they must have had the more voice. They had at least
minority position of the law committee.
They had at least 3 people who agreed with it. But look what they're saying. No longer find that spiritual enrichment. If you're going to look for no longer finding it spiritual enrichment, you can throw all of Yiddishkeit out. Who needs Shabbos? Who needs Kashrut? Who needs Tarat Mishpacha? I mean, God, what do we need it for? What good does it do us? From their point of view. And then, of course, the real reason is economic reasons. Everyone works. All the businesses are open. In New York, Mamish, I'm told that today, not just the Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, But on Sukkot and on Shavuot and on Pesach, you have endless businesses closed down, even if it's not from people who own it, because there's so much less traffic, so much less is happening that they feel there's no sense keeping open, declare it a holiday like all the Jews, but this is New York. But you can understand, Yantif Sheni, it's not a chok, it's a minhag. Let the rabbi decide. There's no chiyuv. Rabbi Wilfried Shuchat, where was he, Rabbi? Shuchat was in Montreal. Is this the Rabbi Shuchat? He was much more traditional. Urged the retention of the observance of Yantif Sheni. Ah, one of his arguments is that the retention of the observance of the day will serve to, quote, deepen the centrality of Zion, end quote, by keeping alive the sense of Gavod. Ah, this man, this is right on. You hear what he's saying? You live, as my wife says, you live in Gullus, you have to observe 3 days Yom Tov all the time. Finished. Everyone complained this year. They had 3 days in a row of Sukkot. We had 3 days next year too, I understand. We're going to have 3 days in a row of Rosh Hashanah. You and Shabbos, 3 days Sukkot, Shabbos. People were going out of their minds. Ah, your rewards for going in Aliyah. Thursday was Sukkot, Friday you could do whatever you want, and Shabbos was Shabbos. It's a good word that he says. You got to know you're in Gullus. How many conservative Jews would gain this type of message, I don't know. But if it's the Rabbi Shuchat I'm referring to, he was in quite a traditional synagogue in Montreal, and they give him credit for keeping Montreal Orthodox. This is what I'm told from within, that he would not allow innovation. And Montreal today has the largest percentage of Shmirat Shabbat of any city in the Western Hemisphere. They say the Shmirat Shabbat percentage is over 40%. That's what I'm told about. I mean, I was in Montreal a number of years ago. I couldn't believe what I saw there. Wherever you walk, there were stores with Shomer Shabbos, and you have tremendous factors there. You have a Yeshiva Gavoha Litvish. You have Chabad all over the place. They're now honoring, one of the shluchim being honored is the head shaluach in Montreal. He's a new, he ties in with the Gutnik family. His sister's married to Yessel the Gutnik. Then you have the Yedav HaMizrach, who were afraid to come to Israel and made the mistake of choosing Montreal, which is 100 times colder than France and can be. They could be here in Ranana, Herzliya, but you know, they want to make a living, so-called. Today, Baruch Hashem, the economy here is a lot better than Montreal. So then you have that entire crowd. Then you have the Tusha Rebbe outside Montreal, the suburb. He's the biggest Rebbe alive. Baal Motzim, you know, he's in his 90s today. Shmuel, they say he produces miracles. I don't know. But wow. So what he says, Gullus. Now, hold on 1 second. An intermediate position is taken by Rabbi Aaron Blumenthal. Now, first of all, do you know who Rabbi Aaron Blumenthal was? His father was Rabbi Meir Blumenthal, was a Rav in Newark, was a Talmud Chacham, was a Yudakeish Rav, wrote many Svarim. I knew Rabbi Blumenthal. But like everyone of that era, the children all wound up in the seminary. And his son was a very prominent conservative rabbi on the traditional side. And he writes, quote, it would be tragic for us to initiate a program that must lead inevitably to the abandonment of the second day of the festivals. Let those who have no alternative not feel that they are in violation of halacha if they observe only 1 day. But we cannot condone the initiation of decisions about the second day in those congregations which do have regular and meaningful services on it. And here, of course, you have the classic answer. Where there is Yantif Sheni and the rabbi can make a minyan, don't abolish it. Where the rabbi can't make a minyan, you may abolish it. Okay.
I don't know a single shul in Philadelphia
right.
that abolished the second day of Yom Kippur.
No, I agree with you. In my time, there was not one conservative temple. And that has to do that the rabbi, it has to do Simon Greenberg, Har Zion, Philadelphia in general was a more traditional conservative city, even though the Reconstructionist movement reached Philadelphia, but the mainline temples were much more traditional. But anyway, this is Yom Tov Sheni, and I would say today, flip of the coin, to put it very simply, Reform synagogues have no services on Yom Tov Sheni. Conservative synagogues, by and large, certainly do. Today, the conservative Jew is more intelligent, knows a little bit more. The fact that Israel, there you have one day, but we're in the Golah, that type of thinking to a certain degree is rooted. Nevertheless, there probably are a smattering of conservative congregations, not in the major centers, where they probably have only one day. I understand. That's what he's saying. They can't get a minion. That's Rabbi Blumenthal's approach. Rosh Hashanah is interesting too, because the Reform abolished second day Rosh Hashanah, and that is fascinating. That the people there's been a bit of a counter reaction in the Reform movement. Because 2 days Rosh Hashanah is so ingrained in them that some Reform congregations found it hard to accept the abolition of the second day. So it's in reverse, that you'll have Reform generally one day, and yet somewhere they happen to have 2 days. What goes on in Jerusalem? Does anyone know? I think they have only one day here. I don't think they have. In the Hebrew Union College, I think they have only one day, if I'm not mistaken, not 2 days. Okay, let me go one step further and let me tell you a story that I was an eyewitness to. Gentlemen, another problem that comes up that makes no sense from the point of view of Toshav, from the point of view of Sadeh, only if you're a Ger and only if you're Ba'ohel can you understand it. No, you tell me. What is not kosher about wine? What are we talking about? We're not talking about wine that's used in a church. I will agree with you 100% that wine that's used in a church will have a din of Yayin Nesach, miracle of transubstantiation, what they do with the wine, Jesus is blood, the matzah is his flesh. Fine. Gallo Brothers wine that you buy in a store is used in a church? All the French wine, the Italian wine, the Spanish wine, used in a church? Now, this question would not come up today if this was the situation back in 1950. Why not? Today, there is so much endless kosher wine, you can't believe what is available. French, and Spanish, and Australian, and South African, and Italian, and of course, the State of Israel. Kosher wine has won so many awards, it's beyond words. It's beyond words. You see advertisements for kosher wine. It's not just for Kiddush. It's not just sweet. A guy like myself has... Now I've developed a slight taste for these Yavesh, Hatzi Yavesh. All my life, all I drank was this sweet Malaga wine like a kid. What did we have? Concord grape and Malaga, that was it. But then it was a real problem. It's a problem that left deep scars on my soul, as you know. My rabbinate, 61, the destruction of Aaron Rothkopf, the ego that I had, Shmuel, gone and gone forever. It never came back. I got the biggest compliment this year from a rebbetzin, and she doesn't realize how much I appreciated her words. A very intelligent, brilliant, insightful rebbetzin who's been through it said to me, "You have no ego whatsoever." I said, "You're absolutely right." It was beaten out of me at that kiddush with the non-kosher wine in 1961. I mean it with all my heart and soul. Now, people got mad at me, you know. I always tell people sending me a fax or an email to write Rabbi Rakefet. I say, because the secretaries get upset if there's no title. I couldn't care less. They get upset. Don't get the secretaries upset. Gentlemen, what is wrong with wine? Stam yainam. I'll tell you more. You want to be honest, Sammy? What does wine have to do with stam yainam? If I had the power, how dare you have a shot of whiskey with a guy? Today we drink schnapps with a guy. Well, no, let's make a l'chaim, Rabbi. There are plenty of guys in Eretz Yisrael. Chabadnik meets a guy, out comes a bottle of vodka. Within 5 minutes, they're dancing on the table. I just think for a minute what I'm saying. You go to a reception, you can't eat a thing. You have liquor, you have all you can eat. Rabbi, enjoy yourself. Well, what can we do? We're going to talk about it in the Sunday class. I'm preparing major shurim and I had a paskin halacha. Masha, how did the goyim put it? Lo gazrin in gezerat zman hazeh. Masha gazru, gazru. Masha lo gazru, lo gazru. Got me, Danny? So, you can drink. What can I tell you? You get on a plane, they serve schnapps, you're sitting next to a guy, you know, you're in business class, they're treating you like a king, I've been upgraded. All right, mitrink alachayim, Rabbi, give me a blessing for a good year, make good business deal, drinking, you're happy. Who drinks wine? Ah, well, what can we do? It's an open Gemara, Vaidazara, my classmate Hagrach, Hagon Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, Dr. Grach, as you call him, devoted his life to this topic. You pick up his book that he published a year ago, his volume, it's unbelievable. Yeinam! What lumdus is in that book? What Chochmat Yisrael? No one in the world has Reb Chaim's knowledge. No one raised a son in America. Not Reb Meisher, not Reb Yaakov, not Reb Baron, not Reb... You name it. No one raised a son with that knowledge that the Rav raised that little kid in Boston, a Maimonides graduate. You just think for a minute, Sammy, what I just said. It's unbelievable. So, logically speaking, why can't we drink regular wine? Now, I want you to know, this came before the Halachic Commission, mid-50s, Michael. Committee on Jewish Law. If I say commission, erase it, because that's the RCA. It's not the RA, not the Rabbinic Assembly. Who is a member of the committee? Rabbi Raiden. Israel, I write about him in my book. I told you about him. He was a Frum graduate of the seminary, I believe 29 or so. He had the shtela in Inwood. Yeah. Inwood, right beyond Washington Heights. It was then a tremendous Jewish center of Inwood. He came to the Rav Shayurim, raised from children, died young. The Rav was mus with him at his funeral. He was very close to the Rav. And I can tell you, he was on the committee on Stam Yainam when it came up before the committee. And I can remember it like yesterday. He asked Rebbe, what are the sources? What am I going to say? What should I produce? And you know, if you know here, there's a trip of the Raman, and there were kulot that the Ashkenazic Jews took in relation to Stam Yainam, but not Chas v'Chalila drinking it. And I still remember after class, the Rav is sitting here, and he calls over Rav Aaron, says to Aaron, Aaron is sitting there, Rabbi Raiden is sitting here, and the Rav is dictating the sources, and Rav Aaron is writing down, and he's telling Aaron, you'll sit with Rabbi Raiden afterwards, show him the sources, and anything he needs help on, you help him. And then, due to that meeting, he went back and he presented a paper with all the sources against permitting Stam Yainam, period. A number of rabbis agreed with him. It may have even been the majority opinion, but of course there was the minority opinion that for religious purposes, rituals, you use only kosher wine. But outside of kosher wine for rituals, bizman hazeh, when there is no shaila whatsoever about the wine having anything unkosher, and when there's no shaila whatsoever about the wine not having been used for sacramental purposes by the Catholic Church or by any other religion, it's a sealed bottle from a major manufacturer, you are allowed to drink non-kosher wine. I think it's fair to say that the majority followed the minority opinion and the minority followed the majority opinion. But that was, to the best of my knowledge, I know there was an opinion as well that bizman hazeh, there's no concept of non-kosher wine, it comes from a manufacturer, it's nothing to do with an individual, it's part of the thinking that gets involved with Bishul Akum, and why we can be more maker with Bishul Akum, because we're buying from a company, we're buying from an anonymous producer, we're not coming from a private home, it's not Bishul by an Akum for an Akum, it's Bishul by a commercial firm done for anonymous people. I don't know whether that carried three votes, but I know there was talk at the time, I remember in the yeshiva, that they were quoting the various opinions on Stam Yenam. And I want to end off, the most important I leave for next week, but I just want to end off. This was one of my children's greatest culture shocks, because on the boat coming in Aliyah, I told you the story, with the rope down the middle, there was a kosher section and a treif section. And one Friday night I got back late and we were eating at the last table in the kosher section right next to the rope. And right opposite us, a man gets up without a yarmulke, with nothing, and he makes a Borei Pri HaGafen and Kiddush on treif wine. But I have to tell you, he was not a conservative rabbi, he was a reform rabbi. I believe I told you that when we spoke about reform Judaism, but I remember my children's culture shocks. So that was a burning issue, and that was the opinion that the Rav had great influence, because Rabbi Radin came with all these complaints that the other rabbis are saying, they evidently had discussed the issue, and it's a factory, and it's a firm, and it's not an individual, and it's a sealed bottle, and the Rav gave him all the sources. Rabbi Lichtenstein, I wonder if Rabbi remembers, played a role, and Rabbi Radin presented a very strong paper that got many of the rabbis to agree that we cannot be matir stam yenam. It differentiates between us and the Gentile world. A minority opinion came in, sacramental purposes, kosher wine, non-sacramental, you can drink any wine, bizman hazeh. Michael, what did you want to say?
No, I mean, I know the person, are you sure it was the minority position?
The heter was, it could be, I don't.
And the person who wrote the position paper.
Right.
Permitting
the
sealed California
right,
wine
right,
that were never touched
right,
by a
right,
human
right,
being.
Well, never touched.
By Israel Silverman. Uh-huh. He was my teacher at Ramah.
You're talking about from Connecticut.
No. Well, he was in Connecticut, but then he
my
was
time
was in Hamilton.
Uh-huh.
Hamilton, Canada.
Uh-huh, I knew from Connecticut.
As far as I know, he was a brilliant halachist.
And then you say that was the most. You may be right.
Basically, the issue was that here you had no issue.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
No issues of kashrut.
I understand.
Whatsoever.
You're quoting me. You're
there
quoting
no
me.
No issues of any human being.
You
ever
are quoting me.
Along.
You are quoting me.
No issues whatsoever.
You're quoting me. That's exactly.
No, certainly not for any religious.
Right,
purpose.
Right. You're quoting me again. No.
Basically, he only permitted. I mean, the issue of European wines apparently had to do with the use of ox blood or something like that.
That I don't know about. But it was Rabbi Radin who wrote the tshuva assuring it, and that tshuva got support as a valid opinion. And that was Radin, like from the city Rotten. And it was all because of the Rav and Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. I can still remember Rabbi Radin sitting there with some of the books that the Rav recommended or would recommend, was sitting there with Svarim in front of him, and he made up to meet Reb Aaron later, and they would sit down and go through everything with Chavruta, and I can still remember him taking notes on the sources.
The halakhic sources, you know, in terms of Talmudic sources, post-Talmudic sources, they would have no understanding of the way that California wines were made.
Yeah,
for the reasons that they were being made.
Yeah, but you're dealing with grapes. Once you're dealing with grapes, it's tam yenum. In other words, this is the problem. Once the grapes turn into liquid, you have a problem. You have mekilim with stomping on the grapes. That's chaim salivation.
But they weren't being stomped on.
I understand, but whatever the stomping process is, it doesn't mean they have to be stomped on. It means you can use machinery. But then if a Gentile touches it, what comes out of the grapes?
They're touched by a Gentile?
I don't know. This is the heart of the problem. You might be able to make a case that it's all done by machines.
No, regular grapes, the California grapes.
Right,
I've never heard of an Easter of not eating California grapes.
No, I'm saying the problem is when the liquid comes out of them. That's where the problem begins.
But it wasn't done by a person.
Okay, beside it. I don't know. It could be you're making a case.
All by machines.
All by machines to the ceiling and everything else. Interesting. And if you recall, what's the famous grape juice in America?
Welsh's.
What's it called?
Welsh's.
Welsh's. And the OU gave Hechsher for a while.
Eventually.
And then they dropped the Hechsher.
I think Welsh's still has a Hechsher.
No, they dropped the Hechsher.
Completely, you sure?
Yeah.
Why did they drop it?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking.
It
wasn't selling because our taste buds like the sweet grape juice, and that isn't sweet because we've been educated that way. No, it's true. Yeah, what did you want to say?
One thing I noticed about almost all the sugars they've given, there's this thing that they have within them. It's like, don't use it for kidded. If you're making a thing, you're saying it's mother, then why is this? They have this reluctance to go too far.
But
the whole nature of the thing is that they're sort of the token killer. They're not going to keep. None of these people who are running these streets are going to drink Stam Yenom.
Look,
the whole movement is going to collapse.
Look.
Because the brother came from it and nobody else did.
Look, I'll be Malamed Schut. They may have felt that buying a kosher wine, the people would buy more kosher products. I can understand it.
But they're setting up the whole conservative movement to fail because they're saying, we Rabbanim are going to keep the halakha and we're running shuvahs.
I don't think they're setting up the. I think this is the reality of the Geva Toshav conflict, and ultimately the Toshav wins out, as we will see.
But you. For Chalav Yisrael, the institutions, yeshiva, should buy Chalav Yisrael. Everyone else can have the whole stuff.
Reb Meisha, no, say that. Okay, to read. No, there have to be, because you see here the reflection of the Psach. But I know in Philadelphia, in my time, I don't recall one conservative temple not having second-day yontif.
Even schools with extremely reconstructionist rabbis. Extremely.
Right.
I
know in Philadelphia, you're absolutely right. I know in New York, I don't believe there's a conservative temple that abolished second day. But again, across the length and breadth of America, if you see how the question came in, how the question was answered, there had to be. Okay.
The
anyway.
The in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Under the conservative. They served Goyish Yawan.
Okay. We said that there was the Hetan from their point of view, absolutely. The Chiddush was that there was a minority opinion that you cannot use non-kosher wine. And I told the class, you were out, that this came about because of the Rambam I described how. Okay, anyway, to reiterate. Look, it's a fascinating topic, and it would be interesting to know if all these tshuvot are published in detail, if you have access to them, if they're online, where are the tshuvot written for the Committee on Jewish Law of the Rabbinical Assembly. I can tell you, if you want to try to find out the tshuvot written by the Halachic Commission of the RCA, they don't exist anymore. Everything was lost when the RCA moved. The best we have is Louis Bernstein's doctorate, The Emergence of the Rabbinical Council of America. If I'm quoting the title correctly, it's published by Shengold. Challenge and Mission, The Emergence of the Rabbinical Council of America. You can get the exact title in the bibliography of my work on the Rav or some of my other publications. And there you have a synopsis of all the problems that came before the Halakhic Commission in the 50s into the 60s. It's very fascinating.
What did Rav Chaim Soloveitchik write?
Rav Chaim wrote an unbelievable volume on the halachic aspects of some Yehudim. The Unterste Shura was that Rabbeinu Tam was accepted as the Posek Mufak. He carried the day, and on one of the most basic issues the Jews in Eastern Europe were mekil, following Rabbeinu Tam, that who stamped on the graves? Non-Jews. And they were posek lahalacha lahakel, that at that stage it doesn't become stam yainim yet. That the stamping on the graves and creating the liquid that then goes into the next process of development or manufacture, it's not stam yainim. From the next process on, the goyim could have no role.
So,
and he shows all the rishonim and the machloket, and he shows the impact of the economic, sociological factors, and this is the way they solved the problem. That and ad the hamakom hazeh hekilu, beyond that they were machmir.
So that way.
And he showed that had you been machmir, you could have never had the wine industry in the hands of the Jews, which it was, because there were never enough Jews to stump out the grapes.
Now today we don't have people running around with their feet.
No, it's done by machine today, of course. But it's the same process.
Right, so the question is this. Where did the goy come into the picture?
I don't know. That's what Michael said. I don't know at what point the goy comes in where he actually touches the machinery of the process of production.
He doesn't touch anything.
No, how do you know? You have to know.
He touches the crates.
Stepping the crates is not a halachic problem. If it's sealed, don't they do that with kosher wine?
Right.
So what's the problem? But obviously with the non-Jewish wine, believe me, the OU and the Chafke and the OK would be the happiest people in the world to give Heksha to what? Why not? Who says that's the Jewish industry? What you say is correct. And when they and spaghetti and noodles and kosher pizza and everything with Hashkacher all over the place. But here there has to be, we have to ask someone, I don't know if Reb Chaim is an expert in manufacture of wine today. We have to ask someone who's an expert today what the process is. Then we can understand what the halacha is.
Is there a question in an RA of a Jewish tourist visiting a church?
Not that I know of. That does not come up in Friedman's article. I never heard that question in my life. And who visited churches then? And if they did visit churches, to where shilas? But that shaila comes up with the Rav. And there are two conflicting opinions that I've heard. One person swears to me the Rav told them, don't go into a church. And one person said, if it's not a time of worship and you only want to see the artwork on the ceiling, then it's okay. I don't know how to answer the question. I got two different answers.
Two different people
asking the Rav the same question and claiming they got two different answers. Okay, so to summarize, gentlemen, it's late. You have Stern to go to, but I want to summarize. What did we do today? We got the feeling of the Committee on Jewish Law. We got an understanding of multi-answers to very difficult questions that are coming in from the field. These are not questions that are from the Ohel. They're from the Sada. They're from the Toshav aspects. And the conservative rabbis are under this unbelievable pressure because this is a third and fourth generation of East Europeans in America. They have lost all connection or most of the connection with the concept of Devach Hashem Zu Halacha, and the rabbis, the conservative rabbis, have to struggle. We saw examples of Yantav Sheni, of Stam Yenum, of weddings during the 3 weeks. Of course, the example of a coin to a grusha, a coin to a giyorot are classic examples, but we still have not touched upon the most important problem of all, the riding to the shul on Shabbat. Next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll pick up with riding, we'll pick up with electricity on Shabbat, we'll pick up with feminism, and then we'll come into the 70s, into the 80s, and we'll see how the seminary literally implodes on the concept of dedication to halacha. It's a sad story because part of that sad story is Matai Yamutu Al Toskenim, which is very sad in that respect, that the students were waiting for the Rebbeim to die, paraphrasing the Midrash with the B'nai Aharon that you're all familiar with. And I'll show you, I don't know, next week or the week afterwards, I'll show you two documents that are hair-raising. Yitzhak and I will wear toupees to class, so whatever hair we lose will be from the toupees. The rest of you will suffer. Some freebies, Yitzhak, the latest, he raises Asher Weiss' very interesting question. Why was Yitzhak so upset that he gave the bracha to Yaakov? He can retract it. It's a bracha al tanai. He made a mistake. Bracha betad, mekach ta'ud. Very interesting question. Anyone who's an artist, this is from the Yeshiva University Museum. And it's fascinating what they have there. But I have to go on record that I wrote them a letter suggesting a certain artist and his artwork, and I never even got an answer. I sent two emails. One, my student works there. She passed it on to the boss. The boss never answered me. Then I emailed the boss directly, and I never even got an answer. I consider that a chilul kvod yeshiva university.
Oh, really?
I may be a nothing, a nice swap, a dummy, living in Jerusalem. Who gives a hoot? It's an artist in Baltimore who does glass work. That's the latest Kol HaMavaseh, and this is the latest Observer of Stern College. Reading the articles, I'm happy to say nothing has changed. The problems that bothered us in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s.
How do you get
the new? A student brought it to me, a gift. He was at YU and came to Israel. Into we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vidanya.
Two things. What language are they writing the Shuvat?
Shuvat in English.
Occasionally in Hebrew. Didn't